This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you very much for tuning in today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in political trouble and could be ousted later this week. We spoke about this on last Friday's Week in Review. We're going to have a conversation with our Jerusalem correspondent Brent Nachtigall, where we step back and look at the bigger picture, the parallels between what is happening in Israel and the political situation in America right now are quite startling. In our second segment, we'll look at the state elections that took place in Germany this past Sunday. In the state of Saxony-Anhalt, predictions for a big win for the far-right party Alternative for Deutschland didn't materialize. The Christian Democratic Union candidate outperformed expectations and won there. We're going to have a conversation with Trumpet writer Josue Michels about what this means that a strong Catholic who's part of Angela Merkel's political party did well in this election and what this might portend for the national election in September. Then we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about the Tulsa race massacre, which occurred 100 years ago last week. It's important history to look back on, but so many of those who are focusing on this are using it for very dangerous purposes, inflaming already strained race relations in America. And I'll finish the program by talking about how to dig gold nuggets out of the biblical book of Proverbs. But let's start with Israeli politics. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Jerusalem, the host of the Watch Jerusalem podcast, Brent Nachtigall. Hello, Brent.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
So we spoke last Friday about this effort to oust Benjamin Netanyahu. The new government is set to be sworn in this coming Sunday. How do things stand at this point?
Yeah, it looks like we have a couple of days before Mr. Netanyahu is without any hope left of kind of some way dissolving this unity government before it comes into power. Obviously, once it's sworn in the Knesset, then that is officially the government, the new government. Mr. Netanyahu would go into the opposition. Naftali Bennett, the leader of Yamina, he would then be the prime minister. And so we do have over these next few days a lot of attempts by Mr. Netanyahu and others to try and break apart the coalition before it gets to that stage. He is trying to talk to every single member of the right-wing groups to try and entice them away from joining this unity government, since they only have a 61-seat or a one-seat kind of buffer before going to a fifth election. So that's razor-thin, I would say, majority this unity government has. And so Netanyahu seems to be pulling out all stops, really increasing the tone and the of his rhetoric to be very dire, painting what's about to be happening in very dire terms with this new unity government coming to power and him being out of power. In similar terms, as even you mentioned in the beginning, that President Trump framed the discussion with Joe Biden taking over and what that was going to do for the country and what Americans could try and do to try and show will stop that, or at least try and show that they disagree with the outcome of the election.
Now, I definitely want to get into some of the parallels that you just mentioned between what's happening in Israel and America. First, just to button this point down, we spoke last Friday about what a motley collection of parties this is to form this unity government. Is there any chance that it could actually break apart still before it's sworn in?
Yeah, and perhaps we can speak about one of those things that could happen to the end of the discussion. But there are still a lot of reasons to believe that Netanyahu could really be very persuasive in framing the discussion with some of these right wingers that they are not going to be voted in again if there's another election at some point, because they have betrayed their voters, a lot of them. And if he can put that case in forceful terms, they might defect already before
over the next couple of days. But as you said, this is a motley crew, eight different parties coming together, three on the right, two in the center, two on the left, and an Arab party for the first time coming together. And Israelis are furious about this. Many Israelis on the right, I should say, are furious about this, especially those that did vote for Naftali Bennett. He is the leader of the Yamina party. And going into the election, as we covered on Friday, it was assumed, not assumed, the electorate was told outright that Naftali Bennett had said numerous times publicly that he would never, ever go into a coalition with Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid, who was the second leading vote getter in the election. He even signed a contract live on television stating that he would not do this. And so this was prior to the election. And so people are going into the election feeling pretty confident that Naftali Bennett isn't going to do what he just did. And they would vote for him on that basis. Polls show right now after the fact that he would lose 2/3 of his voters if he had told them at the beginning, before the election. So that means that everyone, as even Netanyahu had said, that voted for him, they do feel defrauded. It was a con job. They were conned into voting for Naftali Bennett, believing that he would side with Netanyahu, at which point right now you would have a right-wing government. Netanyahu would be prime minister again. However, as soon as the election rolled around, after which he decided to totally desert that position and join the boys, join those that for four elections had one singular goal, that of taking out Netanyahu. So it's not just a betrayal of his voters, it's a betrayal of his voters to and joining those that were pulling out all stops to remove Netanyahu in the first place, which is the reason we've had so many elections. And so people are furious over this. They do feel defrauded. And Netanyahu has spoken in no uncertain terms that he believes that this election was stolen based on that reasoning.
Okay, this is where the parallels really begin to get interesting, and just the case that you laid out here, it definitely seems like strong evidence supporting what Benjamin Netanyahu is contending here. He said it's the greatest election fraud in Israeli history and in the history of democracies. You're talking about the just outright defrauding of the voters on the part of this one politician. What other evidence is there underscoring Netanyahu's claim there?
Well, I think that honestly, that is the main topic. I don't think there's any type of nefarious action in poll booths going on. Yeah. Not this time. That was attempted in previous elections to oust Netanyahu, going back to 2015, with Obama-led NGOs and such that were trying to get Arabs out to vote with extreme numbers. I don't think that happened this time. But I do think that there is something that needs to be said for a politician that receives votes. It's almost in the way that Naftali Bennett did. Like, had he revealed his position earlier and not lied about it in so many different ways, like I wonder if it's even illegal in some fashion what he did, to assign a contract to say that you wouldn't do something in order to get votes and then revert your position. That completely changes the makeup of the Israeli government, takes it from a right-wing Zionist government that believes in Israel's right to all of the Israel to a left-wing government that has a prime minister, if you can imagine it, that won 6% of the vote. This has never happened. I think that's what he's talking about in terms of democracy. This has never been done before. Mm. Even Joe Biden received more than 6% of the vote. But Naftali Bennett is going to be prime minister, and he got 6%. And of that 6%, only 2% would have voted for him had he revealed his position already. So I can understand Netanyahu's reasoning with that statement.
Yeah. That it is really extraordinary. Now, in addition to this contention of election fraud, you actually have some in the media who are looking at the way that Netanyahu is handling this, and the media is very anti-Netanyahu for quite a lot of them. A lot of the mainstream Israeli media, very similar to what you have in the United States. And they're actually coming at him with a similar kind of a game plan that the American media did in coming after Donald Trump. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's several points here. And obviously, seeing what had happened, Netanyahu is going to come out guns blazing, saying this is fraud. The election was stolen. That's similarity number one to what President Trump had said. And then you also have the leader of Shin Bet, which is the internal security agency, coming out and giving an unprecedented statement. So if you like, this could be the intelligence agency internally, like the deep state. And that is what Netanyahu has said. The deep state is on board as well with this unity government that's coming into power. The head of the Shin Bet came out and said that people should stop using language. He said this on Saturday, that might be perceived as one who endorses violent and illegal activities that could even lead to harming individuals, end quote. So he doesn't say this. He doesn't normally intervene in elections, but the head of the security agency came out and said people should tone down the rhetoric. And obviously, he's talking about Netanyahu that's claiming election fraud and such. And there are a couple of comments that Netanyahu made. He said this, don't be afraid to stick it to them. It's part of the scam. Don't be afraid to tell the truth. So people don't like that he said stick it to them because that could be taken literally. Obviously, Netanyahu came out and said, I don't believe in incitement to violence. However, he did say that for the past 2 years, you've had black flag protests every single Friday in Jerusalem throughout cities of Israel that have called for violence to be done to Netanyahu, his son, his wife, but no statement at that point from the leader of the Shin Bet agency. Then you have one of the MKs that is allied with Netanyahu from one of the religious parties. He put out a letter. And this is what his letter said. And this is somebody that is a member of the Knesset. This government is completely contrary to the will of the people as expressed emphatically in the last election. Every effort must be made to prevent this government from being formed. It's not too late. Now, imagine the backlash that occurred in the media all over Israel for this. Every effort must be made to try and stop this. Just like on the January 6th speech by President Trump, you said that they should fight, stand up and fight. Obviously, he's using that metaphorically, as is this man, that you should use every effort to try and stop this fraud from taking place. And he said in response to this, quote, I would have not imagined that every effort means doing something violent. Anyone who knows me knows that's not what I meant. But you can see that the media now is stirring up or exacerbating the tensions themselves through making it out that Netanyahu and the others in his coalition are trying to expressly say to their followers to go out and do some violent acts against the other parties. Now, the defense establishment has been fully on board with this narrative. The Naftali Bennett has already received full prime minister security detail. There's also four of the MKs for Yamina have received security from the state based on what they perceive as threats against them.
They're bracing themselves for a January 6th style insurrection in Israel. They're taking a cue directly from the radical left in America on how to...
Yeah, it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. This is what David Horowitz said. I mean, if you read David Horowitz when he was the editor-in-chief of Jerusalem Post 10 years ago, and then you read what he writes now as the editor-in-chief, founding editor for the Times of Israel, it's almost night and day. He is totally against Netanyahu, but he's bought into all this incitement to violence. He even brings up 1995 when Yitzhak Rabin was killed and Netanyahu was the opposition leader at the time. And people have blamed Netanyahu for the death of Yitzhak Rabin because of some crazed ultra-right-wing person that assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. And he's bringing this up in his column, saying that Netanyahu basically would be blamed for that again if it happened right now. He said, quote, it's a measure of how pyromaniacal Netanyahu now appears that a leader most profoundly appreciated by our divided electorate for his ability to avoid military misadventure is now credibly suspected of being prepared to risk a fresh flare-up with the terror state's army of Hamas if that might somehow prevent his political fall. Now, what he's talking about is getting at something else. This is the the flag march that is meant to happen this Thursday through Jerusalem. This is something that precipitated the violence, or at least Hamas said precipitated the violence, back on May 10th when rockets were fired at Jerusalem for the first time by Hamas in about 7 years. And this looks like it's meant to be going ahead. It was postponed then because the rockets started firing. And it looks like the flag march is going to go ahead on Thursday, although the defense establishment is trying to stop it completely, because they would see Netanyahu as wanting this to happen so that Hamas would then fire rockets, so that if Hamas does that, the Arab Party would not be able to stay inside a unity government that endorses retaliatory strikes on Hamas, and it would blow up the government. And now this might happen.
So this is what This is what you alluded to earlier.
Right.
That this is actually presumably a credible threat to the formation of this government.
Right. Yeah. A flag march. Now this flag march has happened every year for the past few decades through the Old City. Hamas did not say that was this is the cause for war or the reason that we're going to fight against Israel, but they decided that they would do that on May 10th this year. And so many Israelis on the right, and even Likud, are saying that, what do we do now? Do we just follow what Hamas says? Hamas doesn't believe that Jerusalem is our sovereign territory, so we're not going to do our flag march. Well, this is a month later. And typically in Jewish law, if there's a delay, you do it the next month. And so they're trying to do it on May 10th. June 10th, and it just falls in line inside this period before the Knesset will be sworn in. Mm. Now, imagine if this does happen. Imagine if come Thursday we do have a march, Hamas retaliates, and then the government does bust up. Now you have this situation where every media organization in Israel, plus all these people on the left, are going to be saying that Netanyahu wanted a war with Hamas, put Israeli lives at risk just for his political survival, if you can imagine that. The media is already setting Israel up for this. So I don't know if that'll happen, but just the way that the media is playing into this to oust a very popular politician in Israel, the most popular politician in Israel still, by the will of the people, who would be prime minister again had Naftali Bennett not lied over and over and over again. It's a stunning thing to behold, especially so soon after what happened in the United States. Mm-hmm. Can't the media see that we see that they're just playing the same narrative that they played against Donald Trump? You would think so, but they're doing it again.
Apparently can't help themselves. This is their nature expressing itself in a very politically fraught situation. And I guess we'll find out what happens here over the next couple of days. We got to keep our eyes on Jerusalem. Watch Jerusalem as the website that we our sister website to thetrumpet.com tells us. Always a pleasure to get your perspective on these events, and we appreciate you keeping such a close eye on them. We've been talking with our Jerusalem correspondent Brent Nachtigall about really the fascinating parallels between Israel's political mess right now and that in America. He's working on a Trumpet brief about this. It should go out later today. And while I'm at it, I'd like to draw attention to the tribute video Brent did at watchjerusalem.co.il for Dr. Elat Mazar, who recently died. It's an outstanding look back at some of the most extraordinary archaeological discoveries of this outstanding woman. And also, it has some lovely personal comments about what it was like working with her. It's called Digging with Dr. Elat Mazar. You can find that in the Watch Jerusalem box on the front page of thetrumpet.com or at that website. And we'll also link to it in the show notes for today's Trumpet Hour. Thanks so much, Brent. Appreciate it.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This past Sunday, state elections were held in Germany and yielded some very interesting results. We keep a close eye on German politics because of the role that Germany plays in end-time biblical prophecy. To talk about the implications of what happened this past Sunday, we have our man on staff who stays right up to date with all things German, trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello, Josue.
Hello, Mr. Elika.
So there were some surprises in this election. We've been hearing about the death knell for the Christian Democratic Union. We've also been watching the star of the Alternative for Deutschland party rising, and a lot of people expected those trends to continue. That isn't quite what happened here. Tell us how people voted and what it tells us about Germany today.
Yes, Germany is very important to watch right now, because the elections coming up in September that will potentially change the course of that nation and all of Europe. So we're watching Germany very closely, and one indication on how things might turn out in September were state election in Saxony-Anhalt, where the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland party, the far-right party, was supposed to come in first. At least many polls indicated that. But then something happened that no one really expected, even the CDU didn't expect it. The CDU didn't only come in first, they gained 37% of the vote, and the AfD, that many expected would come first, came only in second with 21% of the votes. That was in Eastern Germany, where the AfD has a stronghold in many of those states. Another strong sign that things might not turn out as the polls indicate right now is that the Green Party only got around 6% in the state election, and they are hoping to win the federal election in September. Now, they're naturally less strong in the East, but that also shows that such a party may not be able to go for the victory in September.
Okay, let's talk about the CDU and the AfD here for a moment. First of all, the fact that the big headline was that the Alternative for Deutschland party only got 21% is kind of significant in and of itself, right?
Yes, that's a scary indication on how we got used to far-right mentalities. And especially the polls indicate that the young people were voting for the far-right party. Now, the AfD is against refugees. And in Eastern Germany, there are less refugees than, like, say, in Southern Germany. But they are also very non-apologetic about Germany's Nazi history. So there are very big concerns that the young people are forgetting about history and are drifting to similar slogans that were used in World War II history. And then also we had the conservative party, the CDU. So we have the CDU, which is conservative, also to the right in Eastern Germany, and the AfD, which is far right. So you had more than 50% voting for a right or far right party.
Mm-hmm. And the CDU has been around for a long time, much more mainstream, certainly, than the AfD. Tell us what the CDU represents in terms of the thinking of the voters, the fact that the polls were so far wrong, that there was far more support for the CDU than was expected. And then we can talk also about the individual who was leading the party in that state and who the voters put into power here.
Yes, that's right. The CDU got a landslide victory here, and the polls couldn't predict that. And we don't really know how things changed, but some have said that because so many people are afraid of the AfD, that more people turned out to vote for the CDU than expected to just prevent an AfD victory or a rise of another party. So that's some indications of why things might have turned out the way that they did. And the CDU, as you said, they have been around for a long time, so they are standing for stability, and they're standing for the nation to move forward, and people are voting for them because they know what they are getting, and the other party might bring instability for some time, and people don't like that. And as you said, they have been a long time in governance.
So the CDU is actually Angela Merkel's party. Maybe you could just tell us about I would think a lot of people would look at this as basically a pretty strong endorsement of more of the political status quo. But there are a whole lot of reasons why people should recognize the status quo in Germany is not going to remain.
Yes, that's right. So the Christian Democratic Union has been around since after World War II, and they have been governing Germany for decades. So people voting for it may seem like democracy has been saved again against forces like the AfD or the Green Party. So we are seeing that people kind of, and I saw quite a few headlines that said essentially democracy was saved. But if you look at the establishment of the Christian Democratic Union, it was during Adenauer's time and was essentially a continuation of many Nazi policies. So many politicians, once who said 85% of the politicians in the Bonn area, the former capital of Western Germany, they were former Nazi politicians or served under Hitler. So those were basically people that went into underground. They changed some of their language, but many of the policies were still pushing the same agendas as Adolf Hitler did.
Okay, so let's talk about the individual who actually won, Rainer Haseloff. It's interesting you bring up the history of the CDU. In some ways, he kind of represents some of that what the CDU has always represented, including a religious aspect. That's kind of interesting.
Yes, he's definitely more conservative, and he has to be in Eastern Germany, where people have a desire for such policies. So, and he's an altar gentleman, and he's also a devout Catholic, and that's very, very interesting, because in Saxony-Anhalt, there are only like 3% of the populace that is Catholic, which is the least Catholic in almost any region in the world, because there was the Lutheran Reformation in Eastern Germany, and then we had a drift to communism and socialist policies under the GDR when the Soviet Russia occupied Eastern Germany. So for him to be a devout Catholic is quite unusual, and apparently it doesn't serve him in a negative way as far as gaining votes for the party is concerned.
How much does the fact that you had a man who openly campaigns with Catholic ideals performing this well in a part of the country that is such a slim minority Catholic, what does this bode for this coming election this September, do you think, nationally?
Yes, I think we can expect surprises. It's really hard to predict anything right now in Germany, with the moods changing so swiftly in a matter of weeks. And we still have a few months to go, so it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen in September, but we can say for sure that what we assume may not be right, because many people assumed that Armin Laschet, who is running for the CDU on the national level, will not have a good chance in those elections because he's unpopular in Eastern Germany, because the AfD has much more conservative views and standards. So they were fearing that his candidacy for the September election would be detrimental for the state election in Saxony, but it was apparently Saxony-Anhalt, but it was apparently the opposite. So it will be interesting to see if he can pull a similar election victory surprise in the national election.
Talk more about this national candidate for the CDU that is expecting to, that's running for chancellor this coming September, Laschet. He is also quite religious.
Yes. He's also quite religious, and he's also a fan of the medieval emperor Charlemagne, who was a mass murderer in the 8th century. And he led many wars actually in Eastern Germany to convert them to Catholicism at the time. So this election is interesting in that sense, because Charlemagne was the one that united Europe under the Catholic faith, and we're kind of seeing a religious revival in politics, with more politics like Armin Laschet to promote Catholicism rather openly. And he has also a close advisor that some consider an arch-Catholic, who is basically a shadow man for Laschet, and he has been rather quiet in recent years because he has been criticized for some of his staunch Catholic opinions, but he's definitely still working in the background, supporting and advising Laschet. And Laschet is from the Bonn region, North Rhine-Westphalia, where the Nazi underground movement has settled, as I have previously mentioned. And it wasn't this religious group, this politician and religious group basically has been ruling Germany ever since Adenauer, till Angela Merkel came along and has been ruling Germany for the last 16 years. So we have seen a break from the original Catholic politicians ruling Germany with Angela Merkel, that is Protestant. So we are seeing a shift back where more Catholics are going to be ruling, and many of his colleagues that Armin Laschet is promoting in his campaign have also similar Catholic faith as he does.
So do you see this as being the big takeaway from what happened in Saxony-Anhalt this last Sunday, that there's a greater appetite for Catholicism being a part of German politics than was recognized before? It's certainly something that we would be very interested in because of what Bible prophecy says specifically about the marriage between German politics and Roman Catholicism.
Yes, I think the main takeaway is that politicians are not afraid to state their Catholic beliefs anymore, and they're not afraid to promote them in a campaign. There just have been a few incidences where they have promoted their Catholic faith, but the way the public responded, there was quite a bit of publicity around it. So I think the main takeaway is that we can expect surprises, and we definitely can expect the Catholic Church to be more involved, especially as they try to fend off some of the extremist party. They basically are saying we have a common cause to fight for, and as crises intensify, we can see that both politicians are getting under more scrutiny and more pressure, and the Catholic Church is getting under more pressure. So those pressures are going to force them together, and I think that's what we can expect.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about state elections in Saxony-Anhalt in Germany this past Sunday. He's written an article that should appear at thetrumpet.com. If it's not up there already, you can check that out there at the website. Thank you very much for your time, Josue.
Thanks for having me again.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
On the 100th anniversary of the event, we're hearing a lot about the Tulsa Race Massacre. It's important history to remember, but some leaders are using it in a dangerous way, as we will now hear in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
Last week, Joe Biden became the first man sitting in the Oval Office to visit Tulsa to commemorate the Tulsa Race Massacre of May 31st, 1921. On that day, 100 years ago in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 350 people died as Black Americans were shot, bombed, and stabbed by their white countrymen. Here, I thought, was an excellent opportunity for Mr. Biden to unite America by showing how far it had come since that dark day. But in his address, Mr. Biden said that race relations in America since 1921 have not improved. In fact, he said that the same spirit of hate that drove the Ku Klux Klan at the height of its popularity, the same spirit that inspired lynchings and spawned racially motivated violence in post-Civil War America, is still as prevalent today as it was a century ago. He said that this is because hate is never defeated. The Tulsa Race Massacre is one of the darkest blots in the pages of American history. Many commentators and analysts have admitted to having heard very little, if anything, of the Tulsa Massacre. I've spoken to several people who have never heard of it either. But it is a history worth knowing and learning from. It is also worth being analyzed objectively. Because for far too many today, that event is far more about the agenda to unravel the US social fabric than about the history itself. So let's look at the history of this day a little bit. In 1920, Greenwood District in Tulsa had emerged as a thriving community for African Americans. Around 10,000 blacks lived and owned businesses there, enjoying a pretty high quality of life. It was so successful, it was actually nicknamed Black Wall Street. But this was about 50 years after the Civil War, after the Reconstruction era. Racial tensions were still very high, and some Americans found the reality of a successful black community pretty hard to stomach. And so on May 30th, 1921, everything came to a head. Dick Rowland, a 19-year-old black man, went into an elevator operated by a young white woman. The details of what happened inside are unclear, but the young woman screamed and accused Rowland of sexual assault. But according to a Red Cross report from 1921, all he had done was accidentally step on her toes. Regardless, Rowland fled the scene before he was arrested and taken to the police station the next day. By then, though, word had spread throughout the city of a black man who had sexually assaulted a young white woman. A small mob proceeded to form at the police station to forcibly take Rowland from the police and lynch him. From then on, it was a perfect storm. A group of about 25 black men came together to protect Rowland, and when 50 others joined in, it fueled rumors that the blacks were starting an insurrection in Tulsa. And to quell this supposed uprising, the lynch mob swelled to 1,500 men, who met the 75 in front of the police station. The situation was tense for hours, the two groups effectively at a standoff. But around 10 p.m., bedlam broke out. And it's unclear who fired the first shot, but fire they did, and a chaotic gun battle ensued. The rumors of black reinforcements coming in from all over Tulsa fed into the hysteria. Thus, the mob killed the outnumbered 75 and then surged into the wealthy Greenwood district, where it shot and killed more blacks by the dozens. Some peeled off and used airplanes to drop incendiaries from the air as the mob set most of the district on fire. 35 city blocks were looted. Over 1,200 homes and businesses were set ablaze, and much of Black Wall Street was razed to the ground. By the end, at least 350 people had died. Unofficial counts put the number of white casualties at 48 and black casualties around 300. An additional 700 were wounded, while 6,000 were shepherded into internment camps. Meanwhile, property losses of homes and business amounted to about $27 million, adjusted for inflation, in claims that weren't paid. According to the Oklahoma Commission into the riots of 2001, not one of these criminal acts was then or ever has been prosecuted or punished by the government at any level. We hear a lot about America's history today. We live in the age of the 1619 Project, of institutional racism, of centuries-long black genocide. We live in a highly opinionated and emotionally charged environment, which I found takes work and effort to find truth that's free from fiction. Most history is either taught or even fabricated to suit one agenda or another. The history of May 31st, 1921 is one worth remembering. It shows how the end of the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation weren't simply a magic bullet for race relations. Tensions were still charged and divisions remained. Just 4 years after 1921, nationwide Ku Klux membership peaked at 60,000. Such history is important to know and to learn from, and in an ideal world, it would serve as a jarring contrast to the present. It would be a helpful reminder of how far America has come. But this history is emerging into the public knowledge at a time when the dialogue about race is tense and toxic. Many are using and manipulating this history to drive a false narrative and agenda. In his June 1st address, Mr. Biden conflated the lynch mob in Tulsa 100 years ago and the constitutional conservatives who were against the removal of statues in Charlottesville in 2017 and to the January 6th protesters. Here's what he said.
Just close your eyes and remember what you saw in Charlottesville 4 years ago on television. Neo-Nazis, white supremacists, the KKK, coming out of those fields at night, Virginia, with lighted torches, the veins bulging on their as they were screaming. Remember, just close your eyes and picture what it was. Well, Mother Fletcher said when she saw the insurrection at the Capitol on January the 9th, it broke her heart. A mob of violent white extremists, thugs, said reminded her of what happened here in Greenwood 100 years ago. Look around at the various hate crimes against Asian Americans and Jewish Americans. Hate that never goes away. Hate only hides. I didn't realize hate's never defeated. It only hides. It hides. And given a little bit of oxygen, just a little bit of oxygen by its leaders, it comes out of there from under the rock like it was happening again, as if it never went away.
The Greenwood Massacre was a tragedy. It was an unjustifiable and condemnable event. But America then and America now are completely different. In 1921, about 0.05% of Americans were members of the KKK. Not in and of itself a very high number, but today, it barely survives with less than 0.001%. During the Tulsa Massacre, 300 black people were killed in 24 hours. In the whole of 2020, a year of record crime, 27 unarmed black men were killed by police, most of whom would have been involved in some kind of criminal activity. America isn't perfect, and I don't think any reasonable person makes such a claim. These figures certainly aren't perfect, but what they are is an irrefutable sign of progress. Refusing to acknowledge that progress, ignoring the decades of progress and the stark difference there is between 1921 and 2021, to say that there has been no progress in 100 years is highly irresponsible and hateful. And the repercussions will be worse than anyone can imagine. Former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill wrote that those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. See, learning history is all about knowing how and why to change. It's crucial to know because it helps us know what to change from. And to do that requires acknowledgement of past wrongs, even those that we haven't personally committed. The prophet Daniel set the example in humble prayer to God. He said, "We have sinned and have committed iniquity and have done wickedly and have rebelled even by departing from your precepts and from your judgments." That's in Daniel 9, verse 5. See, then it was Daniel's people who had turned away from God, not Daniel himself, and yet he acknowledged his people's history and their sins. And in 2 Chronicles 7:14, God says that when his people acknowledge their sins and enact change, then he will forgive them. History is therefore invaluable. But today, the history seems to matter much less than the agenda. The agenda that paints America as incorrigibly and institutionally racist. The agenda which is about seizing power, upending law enforcement, and attacking Judeo-Christian values. The agenda which is about manipulating history and facts to sow division. This agenda has nothing to do with enacting positive change. In his booklet, Ezekiel the End Time Prophet, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, writes, Race is a highly charged subject in the United States today and in many other nations. Past wrongs and present inequalities create fertile ground for hurt, frustration, and anger. Many prominent leaders, both black and white, are deliberately fueling those grievances for their own political gain. They are using race as a deadly weapon. The problems that will result are far more dangerous than they realize. The history of the Tulsa Massacre is being manipulated. By contrasting 100 years ago with today, this history could be used to show how far America has come as a nation. It could help encourage and motivate the nation to continue with the progress. It could show how by turning to God and enacting real change, the dark clouds of the past can be scattered and perfection can be attained. Instead, this history is being used to harden the division. And as Mark 3 verses 24 to 25 say, if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. The Bible has a lot to say about where the manipulation of history and the weaponization of race will lead this country. Mr. Flurry's booklet, America Under Attack, explains the relevant prophecies and what America needs to do to enact real and meaningful change. Request your free copy today.
Thank you very much for that, Rufaro. I think it is amazing how much publicity this event is getting now on the 100th anniversary, and really how ignorant most of us have been about this. I think this really has been history that hasn't received a lot of publicity, and it is important to remember this. I think as I'm seeing the information that's coming out about it and seeing who is talking about it and the way that they're talking about it, that's where it starts to get kind of a little dicey in terms of what are the fruits of the way that it is being discussed. And I think you hit the nail on the head that that you only see more division coming from it. You don't see people that are approaching it with a spirit of reverence and contrition so much as they're using it as a weapon against fellow Americans today. And that really is very different than, say, the spirit of repentance that you were talking about in the Bible examples, where you have people looking back on mistakes in history and repenting on behalf of the nation. That is not a spirit that you see in America today, really, ever. You certainly don't see it with any kind of in broad terms, but you definitely don't see it on the part of the race baiters and the leftists who seem much more interested in retribution than they are in repentance.
You're absolutely right, and it's just been making me wonder, you know, what the goal is for those who are politicizing this history. What do they want to achieve exactly? Because the way I see it, it seems as though they don't believe that, you know, America is capable of change. You know,
right.
If you don't believe that America is capable of change, if you don't believe that, you know, America is different now from how it was 100 years ago, what's the purpose of bringing in this history of making sure that people know it? Because I'd imagine that, you know, the main point of learning about this is, you know, to learn the lessons of the past to make sure that they're not repeated. But if you don't believe that people are capable of change, which is the entire idea behind the argument of institutional racism, you know, the idea of inherent racism in every non-person of color, then what's the point? And that's where you really start to uncover what the agenda is, because they don't really care about the ability to change. It's all about, you know, power. It's all about hate. And I feel bad for a lot of people who are manipulated by the people who are in power. You know, because here's Mr. Biden in a position of influence. He's speaking to several people. You know, obviously not as popular as he's made out to be, but he's still saying things that reach a lot of people. And a lot of people hear him speak and they get angry. And they don't understand the agenda. They don't understand, you know, the fact that there's a whole radical left there that wants power and is doing whatever it can to keep a hold of that power. They're just being angered. Mm-hmm. And they're forgetting about the need for change and for unity and for healing and for harmony from a president who said himself when he was being inaugurated that it's now a time for America to heal. Mm-hmm. And yet things like this are being said. The change which is supposed to be at the heart of it has absolutely nothing to do with the message being sent out.
Yeah, it also makes me very appreciative for the mercy that God shows us when we are repentant, when we do change, and when we ask him for forgiveness and he actually forgives and he says that I separate your sins as far from you as east is from west. He forgives and he forgets. And it's a remarkable quality of God that we all need to try to develop. I think, too, of the article that Gerald Fleury wrote after that incident that happened in Charlottesville, where there was a white man who shot up several black members of a church there, and the people in that church, they were just remarkably forgiving and said, you know, they refused to allow that incident to bring hatred into their hearts. And Mr. Fleury just really commended them for actually following the prescription of the Bible to be forgiving and to strive to have that same kind of a forgiving heart that God has. And that really is the key to being able to live in harmony in a nation like ours, to be able to look back at those things, to, you know, to repent of mistakes that we have made, to forgive one another, and to move forward together as brothers. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about the Tulsa Race Massacre, and he's written an article on this subject that you can read at thetrumpet.com. Certainly appreciate your perspective and having you on the program.
Always a pleasure, sir.
It's time for today's last word.
When I was a teenager, I was advised to go through one chapter of Proverbs each day. Since there are 31 chapters, it's easy to get through the whole book in a month. And I did that with my Revised Standard Version. It has easier to understand language than the King James Version, and I really enjoyed that exercise. I recommend you do the same thing a few times in order to familiarize yourself with all of these surprisingly specific and amazingly relevant bits of advice in this ancient book of wisdom. As I've gotten older, though, I've come to see the benefit in slowing down. If you read 25 to 35 verses of Proverbs in one 10 to 15 minute session, you're going to spend very little time on each one. They won't make a real deep impression on your mind. But when you slow down and you spend more time on each proverb, you'll be amazed at how much more depth you find. Try this. Read Proverbs until you find one that stands out to you. And then spend 10 or 15 minutes just thinking about that one proverb. Ask yourself how it applies to your life. And write down in your own words relevant conclusions that you can draw from what that proverb is saying. I'll give you a few examples from my own journal, just looking at a few verses from Proverbs 17. Verse 1 says, "Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife." Thinking about that verse for a while, this is what I wrote in my journal. Family harmony is more valuable than family prosperity. Contention in a home undermines other blessings. Whatever other blessings you have, they don't amount to much if you're fighting with each other. A family is rich if its members live in unity. Harmony makes a poor family rich. Strife makes a rich family poor. You can get a lot of pleasure just reading the proverb and thinking about it. You might drill deeper by reading the same verse in other translations. The King James Version is usually clear, but you can also try the Revised Standard, the English Standard Version, the Moffat Translation, even the Amplified Bible. Read, think, and write. Verse 2 of Proverbs 17 says, "A wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren." From my journal, "God esteems character over heredity. The conduct of your life is more important than the privilege of your birth. With God, your inheritance is based on your actions, not your ancestry. The roles of the servant and the ruler can change based on their choices. Foolishness can make a prince into a servant. Wisdom can make a servant into a prince." So if you really think about what that verse is saying, Proverbs 17, verse 2, it'll teach you a lot about God and the way he thinks. Let's look at verse 5. It says, "Whoso mocks the poor reproaches his maker, and he that is glad at calamities shall not be unpunished." This is what I wrote down after reading that verse. God hates haughtiness and arrogance. He hates a man looking down on another man. Mocking a person is mocking the God who made him. God takes it personally. He feels a sense of protectiveness toward the poor and the downtrodden. Never lose this perspective in dealing with fellow man. Each individual has a creator to whom you are accountable. God wants to build within each of us the same concern and compassion that he has. When seeing someone down, the proper response is never gladness, but compassion. "I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked," God says, "nor in their poverty, nor their calamity. A man of character may fall into poverty. Righteous people suffer trials, but the man who mocks him or is glad is a sinner, thinking like the accuser of the brethren, and he'll be judged for it. His guilt is absolute, his punishment assured." That proverb, verse 5 of chapter 17, it reveals a lot about the love of God. And it's just one of over 900 verses in the book. And they're all filled with nuggets of spiritual understanding that are worth setting your mind on and making your own. God wants to supply you wonderful understanding and guidance and wisdom. He is crying out to give it to you. He's spread it out before you in the book of Proverbs. It's up to you to take it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on this program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Josue Michels, and Rufaro Manyepa. And thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe: "When a man is old, he must do more than when he was young." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.